This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go? And tonight, returning to the show, I have Aaron Daba. And this is actually going to be a two-part show because Aaron had so much cool stuff that I wanted him to talk about. Tonight's show is going to be all ghost ships and not the ghost ships you've heard of, but some really weird, obscure ghost ships, because that's what Aaron does. He collects these weird, obscure stories. He's very good at it. And I love his storytelling. So we're going to hear that. If you're a Patreon, you're going to get part two right away, plus an extra segment for Patreons only. So without any further ado, here is part one of my conversation with Aaron Daba. All right, Aaron, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Soraya. Good to talk to you again.
And let's get this out of the way right up front. If people want to find more about what type of stuff you're talking about tonight, you have a blog. And where is that?
That blog is esoterix.com. That's esoterix.com. And it's the sort of thing that will keep you up at night.
And how long have you been doing that?
5 or 6 years now.
Okay, so there's a decent amount of stuff on there.
Oh, hundreds and hundreds of articles of stuff you should be afraid of.
Yeah, what's the tagline on that?
If monsters don't exist, why are they out to get me?
I love that.
My brain works and the nascent paranoia that drives my research.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. The last time I had you on, I got a lot of feedback because you're finding stuff that most people have no idea about.
Well, you know, I spend all my time trying to look for things that people aren't currently aware of and probably should be afraid of. And I consider myself the Boy Scout of anomalistics. Be prepared. You know, you might not run into a UFO or a Bigfoot or, you know, a ghost ship or or some sort of demonic entity, but it's best to know what to do if you do, right?
Sure. Absolutely. And we're going to start off talking ghost ships tonight. Cause we've never talked about ghost ships on this show. And you presented that as an option. I went, ooh, ghost ships. Yeah. Well, not just any ghost ships.
That's right. These are going to be some very obscure ghost ship stories that I turned up. And ghost ships are interesting because most people, when you start talking about maritime folklore, they say, well, you know, sailors are a superstitious bunch. And, you know, we can dismiss a lot of this because they just have all these superstitions. And my response to that is always, nah, they really just have to be more aware of what's going on around them, especially for the, you know, past few hundred years, because it's not really been all that safe to be sailing around the world. I mean, prior to global positioning and satellites and things like that, you know, odds are if you left port, you might not make it back. And everybody's heard of the big ghost ships, you know, the Flying Dutchman or the Mary Celeste. You know, these are the big ones that come up again and again. So if anybody says the word ghost ship, that's what you think of. But there are so many ghost ships out there. It's kind of frightening. In fact, not only are there ghost ships, I was doing a little research on why there are so many ghost ships out there that nobody talks about anymore. And I ran across this stuff about the British Navy and that in the 19th century and early 20th century, they had such a problem with derelict ships just kind of floating around the world, you know, ships that had just been abandoned and were floating around, that they were actually charting them and charting reports of them. And it helped them learn a lot about tidal currents because these things would just float in the tide, and it would appear one year, you know, in one place, and next year it would appear somewhere else, and they'd figure out how the currents in the ocean were working. And of course, they would say, well, this is another reason why we can't believe any of these ghost stories. These are probably just sailors seeing derelict ships. The problem is, sailors know the difference between a derelict ship and something really, really creepy that's appeared out of nowhere. So I consider those just comforting ways to tell ourselves that ghost ships don't exist, when in fact, probably there's a whole lot of ghost ships floating around out there, and nothing sucks more than an afterlife of seasickness. But I wanted to give you some choices. I got a few stories here I think might interest you, and you can tell me which one you want me to start with.
All right.
Talk about a ghost ship where the main suspects in the disappearance of the entire crew were a cat and a dog. And we could talk about how the refrigerated meat trade turned out to be very, very dangerous. We can talk about a straight up revenge ghost story, which is always good. And we could talk about Puritan hippies who don't know how to build boats.
Let's start with that one.
Okay, Puritan hippies that don't know how to build boats. You got it. So there's the New Haven Colony. And the New Haven Colony, and this is a fairly early, 1647 was the date when this all started. The New Haven Colony future wasn't looking so bright. They were distinct from the Connecticut Colony. It was a breakaway colony. About 500 Puritans, and I always say it's 500 Puritans who hated the Red Sox, but it was really just 500 Puritans who thought that the Connecticut colony was a little too stringent in their puritanical ways. And they started their own little nation state. And they obviously, you know, like most human beings, had a fondness for food, but they hated farming. It was a bunch of merchants. And New Haven is a rotten place to grow anything but an insurance company anyway. So they quickly ran into trouble. They ran out of money. They couldn't grow anything. So they needed some way, if they wanted to maintain their breakaway colony, to make some money. So they built a ship, and they really didn't give it a name. It wound up being called the Fellowship. And they planned to load it up and with all the goods that they had and trade these goods in England, make some money, and then, you know, start a cycle of, you know, little industries and selling goods back to England. The problem with this is they didn't really know how to build a ship. And so they contacted some folks in Rhode Island another set of Puritans who, you know, they built lots of ships in their yards, but they had not ever built a ship as big as the ship that that the New Haven Colony was asking for. And, you know, they were, pretty lackadaisical, you know, they said, hey, yeah, sure, we'll build you a ship, give us some money, we'll take care of it for you. So they built the ship. And when the ship was brought to New Haven, even the captain who was going to be the captain on the way to England was looking at it and saying, this doesn't look like a very seaworthy ship. And he was worried about the safety of the passengers and the freight. And on top of that, when they started loading her, she was pretty badly laden. And badly laden, you know, I didn't know what it means to be badly laden on a ship in 1647, but I looked it up. And what they did was they loaded a lot of wheat to send back to England, and they loaded wheat on the bottom of the ship. And unfortunately, wheat has a tendency to shift in a storm. And they also put a lot of lighter goods at the bottom of the ship, which is not good for seaworthiness generally. But everybody who saw the ship said, you know, this is not looking that great, but this is our last ditch effort. You know, we're out of money. We spent all our money building this ship. We dumped all our worldly goods into here to sell to England so we can keep things going. Let's set sail. So they made the best of it. They set sail for Europe. And presumably they sank because months passed. No word about the fate of the ship, never arrived in England, never returned to New Haven, at least in corporeal form. And what was interesting is that in a letter from James Pierpont, who's the founder of Yale University, so we can believe him, to the minister Cotton Mather, and folks may remember him as a big fan of the Salem witch trials.
Yeah.
Documenting a report of people observing the return of the ghostly fellowship to New Haven. And they said that it was first noticed by children who saw the ship come flying up into the harbor with all the sails set and flying colors. And it looked exactly like the ship that had left months ago and going strangely flat against the wind. So it was going against the wind. No sailors on her deck, didn't toss with the waves, there's no ripple at the bow, came close to land, and all they could see was a single figure appearing on her quarter deck. And he pointed seaward with a cutlass, and then suddenly the main top fell, the mast toppled, and the whole hulk careened over and went down. And then they added in some other stuff, which is like a cloud dropped from heaven and brooded over it for a time where it had vanished. And then it lifted and the surface of the sea was empty. So basically, they loaded up a really badly built ship, built by a bunch of Puritan hippies in Rhode Island, and never saw it again until it came back as a ghost ship. And the ghost ship sailed into the harbor, promptly sank, and they figured they kind of knew what had happened at that point.
Wow.
the postscript to that, of course, is that New Haven was pretty much screwed by this. But there was a reason for some of these maritime superstitions. They really didn't name it, which was probably another bad idea. They waited until much later to actually give the ship a name. I mean, you're supposed to build the ship, give the ship a name, christen the ship. But these were Puritans, so they didn't believe in baptizing a ship, right?
For sure.
So they didn't baptize the ship as with a name, which is considered awful bad luck. And, of course, it sank and came back as a ghost ship, which is, I guess, it's the same thing as not being baptized as a person, right?
Now, did they look for the ship on the bottom of the harbor?
They did. There was nothing there. They just came in, sank, disappeared completely. Never seen again.
Wow.
Which all tells right, you well, don't let people build your boats, first of all. And and then there's other issues there. It's don't start a colony if you don't know how to farm. I mean, yeah. There's so many lessons we can get from that.
Fair enough. So let's do the cat and dog one.
Oh, the cat and dog one. There is a ghost ship that is known as the Seabird. Now, the Seabird, this is actually a good example of the kind of research that I do. And that's trying to discern fictionalized accounts from real accounts. And right. Not in the sense of trying to decide whether somebody who wrote something as if it was real, if it was just fiction or they're delusional, it's that there are actually several different stories of this, including admittedly fictionalized accounts. We all know how authors like to steal like good ideas and write fiction about them.
Sure.
And so finding out what actually happened to the Seabird is fairly complicated. And it's one of the earliest ghost ships on the Atlantic seaboard of North America. And what happened is that it came aground at Easton's Beach, Rhode Island in 1750, and it was returning at that time from Honduras. And the crew of eight that were on it had completely vanished, and apparently within sight of shore, because coffee was still brewing in the galley, and the ship was still under sail. It was undamaged. It dodged through like dangerous shoals to get to the beach and coasted safely into the beach. So there was no sign of foul play. None of the crew were ever seen again, but a live dog and cat were found on board. Now, the problem starts when you look a little more deeply into the story, and that's that the date of this happening is attributed variously to 1750, 1760, and even 1850. But the dog and cat are always mentioned.
Huh.
And, okay. Occasionally they add a parakeet too, but that, you know, it's I'm sticking with the dog and cat. The other problem is you can never exactly tell who the captain was. It might have been John Huxham or John Husham or John Durham, all from different places. The ship may have floated itself overnight and sailed away, never to be seen again. And it may have been salvaged and used commercially for many years after the incident. Or there's another one. It was parked in Newport Harbor, where it was later captured by the British and turned into an armed gunboat.
Wow.
So after I started finding all these things, it started to make my head hurt. And I tried to figure out where all this information was coming from. And so there's a pretty good set of literature out there about this all happening in 1750. A boat sailed up on the Easton's Beach, coming back from Honduras, and it's oddly, the beach it came up on was called Purgatory Beach, which, you know, I guess not even oddly, that makes a little bit of sense. And when it was coming in, nobody even really noticed it. They thought it was just another ship coming in, you know, big harbor, people are coming in and out all the time. And
sure.
That one was supposedly captained by John Huxham, who had been expected hourly from Honduras and had actually been spoken of by a vessel that had arrived in a port the day before. And they said they had just passed them, which is why they thought that this vessel had been abandoned somewhere within sight of shore.
Huh.
But again, nobody ever heard about anything about the captain and crew ever again, so that it was a little weird. The vessel was supposedly afterwards floated. This is the 1750 story, and sold to a merchant of Newport who renamed it to the Beachbird. And by the way, renaming ships, bad idea. Another big superstition. Rename a ship and you're doomed. Keep the name of the ship, no matter what it is, unless it's the Mary Celeste. If your ship's named Mary Celeste, change the name. But generally, one of those big superstitions is changing the name of the ship.
So do you feel that initial story was probably the most accurate one?
Well, it's hard to tell because there's some complicating matters. In 1750, the Wilmington Delaware Sunday Morning Star, their equivalent of their daily newspaper, I guess, more or less mirrored the event and added something about a crew member who was surviving and hit out in Scandinavia. So again, maybe it's the Daily Mail of the times, and they're just making a good story. But the 1859 version is in rough agreement with the 1750 version. But the 1859 version is actually probably a confusion about dates, because the 1859 version of the story is talked about in the early 19th century. People who were looking into the Seabird started talking about it. But in 1885, a short story was written all about the Seabird, and people tended to, you know, to read these details and the and assume not that they were true, but this was a fictional story. Yet later, people came along and there was this story from the 1750s they'd heard about the seabird. But then in researching it, they'd find the stuff in the 1850s about the seabird. But that stuff from the 1850s was a completely fictional account that somebody wrote as a short story. And what's interesting is that this is the kind of thing you can use. They do this in archaeology. They come up with the what's called the terminus postquem and the terminus antiquem, which is the date limit after which an event could not have happened and the date before which an event could not have happened.
Right.
So we know that we know a couple details from these different stories that all seem to agree. There's three useful bits of information, right? The original owner of the seabird in Newport was a merchant named Isaac Steele. And the owner subsequent to its career as a ghost ship was a guy named Henry Collins. And there's a suggestion that the British commandeered it after the occupation of Newport, right?
Okay.
So that was in 1776. So that means the seabird could not have occurred after 1776.
Right.
Supporting the 1750 date, right? I mean, this all sounds absolutely, you know, we're getting into the weeds here. The simple fact is, this is what tracking down a lot of this stuff is. It's finding a fictional account, finding a real account, finding a newspaper account that may or may not be fictional, and then trying to figure out where these details are coming from. But, you know, basically we have a ghost ship that appeared and gets repeated as a story starting in 1750 and then repeated again all the way into the 1800s. And nobody ever found the crew. Nobody knows anything about what happened to it. So it may just be tales we talk. Sorry, go ahead.
No, like when you look at some of these old newspaper reports, I mean, what percentage of these do you think are just fun stories that they're using to prop up their sales versus how much of this stuff is actually fairly accurate?
Well, I always tell people if there's a poem anywhere near the article, it's probably not, it's probably fiction.
Really?
Yeah.
How come?
It's hard to tell. I mean, this was prior to the age of what they called yellow journalism, where they were doing, you know, some fairly fantastic stuff. But it's hard to tell from newspaper articles. I don't like newspaper articles in particular because they're often, like you say, it's about sales as it is today, and they are telling a good story. So it's finding other sources that are that make something interesting. So you often can start with a newspaper, find a story of, say, the seabird, trace it back, and find that there is earlier stories of the seabird, like the letter from Cotton Mather to the president of Yale University. These are the sort of things that you can trace and say, hey, well, this actually was talked about by people at the time. But what puzzles me most about this, and of course this is sort of my oeuvre, I guess, if I have an oeuvre, whatever, but is that no suspicion ever fell on the cat and dog. And I'm fairly positive that the cat and the dog had something to do with it, because, you know, every story says came ashore, everybody disappeared, looked like they had been there 5 minutes before, yet somehow the cat and dog were just fine.
Huh. Maybe they weren't really a cat and dog.
You gotta wonder. I know that I often think pets are plotting our death, but here's an instance where, you know, they may very well have had something to do with it, and nobody ever suspected them.
All right. So what was the next one there you had on the list?
Well, we can go to. I can tell you all about the incredible dangers in the refrigerated meat trade.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Is that the one you want to go with?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's easy, and that's because this is a good cautionary tale that that we should all take note of, and that's because involves refrigerators, and refrigerators are kind of important to us. I mean, chances are you live where you live because of your refrigerator, and or well, it probably has more to do with you live where you live because of your girlfriend, but she lives where she lives because of her refrigerator. And that's just an entirely tragic situation because your refrigerator hates you. And, you know, you have some hints of this in various popular movies. I mean, Zool, you know, the gatekeeper of Gozer, you know, plotting destruction from your freezer. And what is it?
Sure, back. Sure.
But it's not really personal. It's more a general principle of the universe. Nature abhors refrigeration. And this is absolutely demonstrated by the fact that, number one, a lot of strange phenomena are associated with refrigerators. And more tellingly, the first successful refrigerated cargo ship, the Dunedin, as well as its sister ship, the Marlboro, they both disappeared under mysterious and deeply disturbing circumstances.
Really?
Remember that. What I'm telling people is next time you walk down the frozen meat section of the supermarket, know that's a fateful precipice you're trotting upon there, because before we could ship things around the world, you know, in refrigerated trains and ships and trucks, and you know, you clustered big cities around places where you could get things quickly, but you know, obviously our population grew too fast, and we need to figure a way to get food to places with that were somewhat inhospitable without the food rotting before we got there, and then, you know, obviously not rotting while it was there. And so we had to come up with refrigeration, you know, and this, it's interesting, you know, it changed the way we farmed. You know, you could get oranges to Minnesota, and you didn't have to go to the supermarket every day, and you could build a city in the Nevada desert. But back when they were first trying to figure out how to refrigerate stuff, there were some problems. Or at least when they successfully figured out how to ship stuff around the world refrigerated. Because, I mean, we've been trying to find out a better way to preserve food for millennia, right? I mean, salt
sure.
has been pretty popular, and I personally think that's resulted in species-wide hypertension and explains why we've only had 300 years out of the past 5,000 where we weren't killing each other. Yeah, I mean, in 1000 BC, they tried ice, but ice has this annoying tendency to melt, so they weren't very good at it. And in the 19th century, ice harvesting was hacking at a frozen river with an axe, which, you know, if you're not into hypothermia or drowning, you know, it's not the safest occupation in the world.
Right.
So eventually they figured out how to, you know, harvest ice and then ship things short distances. But shipping things around the world was, you know, that required a different kind of invention. And they tried artificial refrigeration since about 1755, and nothing was commercially viable until a very sharp Australian guy named James Harrison came up with an ether-based vapor compression system, which, don't ask me what that is. I have no idea what an ether-based vapor compression system is, but apparently it's a very effective way of refrigerating stuff.
All right.
And he's Australian, so we can assume his primary goal was to make sure the beer was cold. I mean, if you ever had a summer beer, I mean, they taste awful, right? The summer brews, obviously they're temperature sensitive.
Right.
And then once, you know, obviously they figured out how to refrigerate things, and Australia and New Zealand had cold beer, they needed to make money so they could buy more cold beer, right?
Sure.
So they, luckily the UK in the 1850s was worrying about its food supply, because they were getting most of their beef from the US, and it's not too bad to move beef from the US to the UK, because you only got about 4,000 miles. So, you know, generally you can get stuff there without a lot of spoilage. But if you want to move stuff from Australia or New Zealand to the UK, at best, that's 11,000 miles. And the Suez Canal didn't open until 1869. And so that, it'd be prior to that, involved like going around the Cape of Good Hope or Tierra del Fuego in the other direction. And that's like 13,000 miles. So it's very difficult, obviously, to get stuff there without having your entire cargo rot and then losing all your money. So they discovered a way to refrigerate meat. And the first refrigerated meat left New Zealand in 1882. And it was a complete and utter disaster. Everything rotted. It didn't make it there. They simply were unable to, they had a very, the ice providing the cooling melted too fast. And they, later attempt with sheep and an ether-based refrigeration system failed. And before they even got very far, all the meat had spoiled. And obviously there's lots of cold beer sitting around waiting for people to buy it. So they tried again. And that's when they came up with the new sailing ship Dunedin, which a certain gentleman named William Davidson came up with a compression refrigeration unit, which was a totally different kind of refrigeration unit, stuffed it full of frozen sheep. And in 1882, they set sail for London. They had a few problems. They had to stop, drop off of a certain amount of the carcasses because they had a problem with their rudder rather than the refrigeration system. And so they needed to stop for repairs. So they had to sell off 641 of the sheep. So actually, New Zealanders were the first people to eat their own refrigerated meat.
Huh.
Now the Dunedin arrived in the London docks on May 24th, 1882, 98-day passage, and it sold off its cargo and made an enormous amount of money. So they quickly built it. And the next ship was the Marlborough. It was the Dunedin's sister ship. And it started sailing between New Zealand and the United Kingdom, taking meat, dairy products, all sorts of stuff, back and forth, and making a nice and tidy profit. The problem is both the Dunedin and the Marlborough mysteriously vanished in 1890. And no trace of the Dunedin was ever found. And I mean, people said, well, you know, they're sailing near the Arctic. There's lots of icebergs, which I consider would be a little bit too ironic if a refrigerated ship was sunk by an iceberg. But
right.
That's just me. And the Marlborough similarly disappeared, at least for a number of years. And the British Navy dispatched the HMS Garnet to search for it in 1891. Because there were rumors that crew members were shipwrecked in Tierra del Fuego. They arrived in Tierra del Fuego and found nobody. There was nothing there. And they reported that this was just a fantasy somebody had come up with. But later in 1913, a story came up from Captain MacArthur, who had been commanding a Blue Funnel steamer out of Seattle, and had run into a pilot named Burley, who was once wrecked on Cape Horn and discovered a shipwreck. And he could clearly see the name on Cape Horn on the ship that was Marlborough. And the Marlborough, there were 20 skeletons, he said, when he searched the ship. And that the ship was oddly rotted. Mold all over everything, but the wood was still intact. Now, a lot of skeptics at the time jumped on this and said, oh, you probably saw the Marlborough of London. The problem is they keep naming ships the same damn thing. Which was a ship that also wrecked in the vicinity. But the Singapore Straits Times, which apparently was read by a lot of sailors, reported the Marlboro had been found. And there's some confusion as to what's going on. The story that was reported in the Singapore Straits Times says that it was one of the scariest things he's ever seen. Remains of 10 bodies, 6 were found, 1 alone, maybe that of the captain on the bridge. Stillness and dank smell of mold that made the flesh creep, a few remnants of books in the captain's cabin, and a rusty cutlass. And a quote from him was that nothing more weird in the history of the sea can ever have been seen. So there's basically what happened, I think, was a little bit of, it just kind of reeks of divine retribution, ultimately, the hubris of attempting to not deny like the rotting of flesh.
Right.
And that, you know, it's our the original price of our TV dinners is the unnatural ends of the Dunedin and the Marlboro. And all in the name of beer, no doubt.
I wonder if someone tried to hijack them too or something, considering what they were. I mean, they were pretty unique at the time.
It's entirely possible. They were never seen again, though. It was there's only the story that the Marlboro appeared as a wreck much later, and mostly they assumed that they had simply been well, I mean, it's not particularly safe to sail around Cape Horn and or Tierra del Fuego, so it wouldn't be unexpected for a ship to be lost. But it's the creepiness of the Marlboro being shipwrecked and still sitting in on the Cape, filled with skeletons that I liked.
Yeah.
That, and it was the obvious like fact that nature hates refrigeration, and this was, you know, for our arrogance, it decided to implement a smackdown.
Yeah, those areas are where the oceans meet, so they're very, very tumultuous.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm all about playing the odds. It's like if your first few ships with refrigerated meat disappear inexplicably, well, you know, you might want to consider, you know, at least appeasing the refrigeration gods, if there are such things, before you sail the next few.
Were the next few okay?
Well, yeah, after that, it was such a profitable trade that people started outfitting ships and shipping meat every, you know, here and there and everywhere.
Right, right. That makes sense. I didn't realize that goes that far back.
Yeah, well, I mean, they tried lots of stuff, and they often would end up with a cargo hold full of rotted meat because something would break, you know, midway, you know, the refrigeration unit would break, or the ice would melt, or it's not easy to refrigerate stuff on a ship. Not at least it wasn't in the 19th century. Now, of course, we don't think much of it. You get your full course, delicious gourmet cooked meal on your Viking cruise and things like that without too much trouble.
Right.
But the price we paid for that, I tell you, people don't realize.
And no one ever went back to check that ship again, or any other information on it?
People searched for it and never found it.
Huh.
Which makes it all the more ghostly.
All right. True. Did you have another ghost ship story?
I do have another ghost ship story, and this is probably among the creepiest of the ghost ship stories. This is the story of the Charles Haskell and the Andrew Johnson, and pretty well documented story too. I like to start this one off. It was a dark and stormy night on March 6th, 1869. Yeah, I always wanted to say that. It was 1869, and the Andrew Johnson and the Charles Haskell were two ships that were cod fishing ships. And the good ship Charles Haskell was a 65-ton cod fishing schooner built in Cape Ann, Massachusetts, and was caught in a nasty storm right off the Georges Bank. Now, the Charles Haskell, sadly, was probably cursed from day one. And even before she left dry dock on her maiden voyage, a workman slipped and broke his neck on her deck. Now that's considered to be like a really bad sign to the nautically savvy, right? So, you know, if that happens and you haven't left dry dock, that's not a ship you want to sail on. You play the odds, you know, somebody's already died there. Someone else is going to die soon. Consequently, the owners at the time couldn't find a crew willing to put to sea on her. So she was, although she was built, she was brand new, beautiful ship. She was put on the auction block. And, you know, if the internet has taught us nothing, it's that everybody is always looking for a bargain. And so they found somebody, a shopper looking for a bargain on ships, and they sold it at auction. And, you know, honestly, we wouldn't have horror movies if it wasn't for these folks. Charles Haskell actually finally put to sea. The captain was Captain Curtis, and they shipped out to the Georges Bank, which is it's a raised seabed between Cape Cod and Nova Scotia, where there's good fishing, especially cod, if you like cod. And when they arrived there, it was crowded, as it usually was, with vessels all fishing. And I assume everybody pretty much looked like the Gordon's fishermen. You know, it was just boat after boat of guys in yellow raincoats standing around, you know,
right,
birds in a pipe in their mouth or something like that. But it was also...
Well, how else would they
look?
Yeah,
really, exactly. but there was a storm that hit, and it was a pretty bad storm. And the Haskell was forced to cut anchor so that they wouldn't sink. They were taken on water. And they inadvertently rammed a nearby schooner. And that schooner was called the Andrew Johnson. Now, the Charles Haskell was badly damaged, but they managed to limp back to port. But the Andrew Johnson sank, taking all 26 crew to a watery grave. And you would think that the Charles Haskell had actually been lucky, because she was the only known vessel to actually survive a collision on the Georges Bank in the 19th century. But... anyway, and I mean, frankly, any shipwreck you can walk away from is a good shipwreck, right?
Right.
But the problem is that the ghost of the Andrew Johnson would pursue the Charles Haskell for the rest of her days. And
really?
Yeah, oh yeah. And there's countless stories, and one of the most telling ones is from... a certain gentleman named John Winters, who was a fisherman who was the last survivor of the crew of the Charles Haskell, which when they sank the Andrew Johnson, and when he died, it was written up in his obituary that he maintained to his dying day that a schooner. While the Haskell was continuing its career as a fishing boat, at one point, at the entrance to Gloucester Harbor, a schooner came down with the wind, hove up alongside the Haskell, and a phantom crew climbed the rigging, declaring themselves the ghosts of the fishermen from the Andrew Johnson. Winters and the Haskell crew came back to shore and refused to sail on it ever again. And so an entirely new crew was taken on to the Charles Haskell, and that crew returned with similar stories about being pursued by this phantom of the Andrew Johnson and ghostly sailors climbing on, and they came back to port and they quit too. And another crew was shipped out, brand new crew again. Came back with the same story, a specter crew, and they eventually had to haul the Charles Haskell up because they were unable to get anybody who would work on it, and it finished its career as a sand freighter along, and it just disappeared into history. It was never heard from again. I actually was heard that it was left to rot in the harbor once they finally couldn't get anyone else to actually man the ship.
Damn. And that's that it's much weirder that it had repeated the same type of ghost encounter over and over.
Yeah. Well, they ran over another ship. They sank it. They survived, and the ghosts were unhappy with that fact, because pretty much everybody else who ever rammed a ship, both ships went down in the Georges Bank.
Hmm. All right, that's definitely a creepy one. is that the last ghost ship story?
There are other ghost ships. Those are the ones that I like just for their weirdness.
Oh, do you have a couple more you could throw us?
A couple more. Yeah, there's off Block Island, Rhode Island. There's a famous set of strange phenomena called the Palatine Lights.
Hmm.
And in the 18th and the 19th century, these were reported as a flaming phantom ship off of Sandy Point, usually around Christmas. And the... considered to be the spectral remnants of an ill-fated vessel beset by nature's wrath, this is a quote from the from a poem that they wrote about it. But in 1752, this ship named the Palatine started from Holland for Philadelphia, and it was packed with new immigrants to the New World. And it was winter in the North Atlantic. Gales and storms drove it far north of its actual course. Mutiny broke out among the crew, and it said that rebellious seamen murdered their captain and took charge of the ship. And then with the water and the food in their control, they sold them to the immigrants that were taking passage at like ridiculous prices, $10 for a biscuit, $5 for a cup of water.
Of course.
When the passengers had spent all their money, they basically were left to starve to death. And eventually the mutineers, with all the money and the valuables of the dead and the survivors, took the boats and abandoned the Palatine to the storms. It was the Christmas week, and the ship went ashore on Block Island. And Block Island was known for wreckers that... and Block Island doesn't like this particular reputation that they have, but in the in the 1700s and 1800s, they would sometimes light fires on the beach to pretend to be towns and things like that to wreck ships on the shoals, so they could then basically steal everything that was on the ship.
Right.
But in this instance, they swarmed the ship. And we're going to strip it bare, but they realized there were tons of miserable half-starved immigrants on it. And so they took them off the ship and took them into their homes. And one of the immigrants had been driven completely insane, basically. I mean, she was without water and food and was quite insane by the horror of the experience and refused to leave the ship. And wouldn't let anybody touch her, wouldn't let them drag her away, and they left her aboard. And the wreckers towed the ship to a sheltered cove, and they were going to strip her at their leisure, of everything else useful and valuable on her. But another gale sprang up and tore the ship away, and the Palatine drifted out to sea. And Block Islanders, rather than do anything to help, set the ship on fire.
How nice of them!
Well, it makes a certain amount of sense. It's like you don't want a lot of nautical navigational hazards out there. That if it's gonna float away, burn it so it doesn't block the harbor, that kind of thing. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt that, or maybe they were just jerks. Who knows? But they unfortunately left the mad woman aboard to burn to death. And for years and years and years afterward, off of Block Island, they've been seeing this blazing ghost ship, and they some people say you can hear the screams, the unearthly screams of the woman that was left aboard to burn to death. And they're called the Palatine Lights when you see them, which of course is a version of the Ignis Fatuus, I think they call them, you know, the old,
like the Marfa lights and such.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the will-o'-wisps, the Ignis Fatuus.
Yeah.
You know, it's the swamp gas of the ocean, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Right, right.
But they searched the Custom House archives and reported, and in fact, in 1870, some historians were interested in what happened, and some inquiries were made to the U.S. consul at Amsterdam, who had from where the ship had sailed, or at least where they imagined the home port of the Palatine to be. And they searched the Custom House archives, and that they did find a record of the ship Palatine, which they said was wrecked in the Bay of Bengal in July 14, 1784. Which is a little odd, because that is nowhere near, obviously, Block Island.
Right.
It's another strange story that seems to appear in multiple places. Now, there's a complicating factor in this one, and that's that the Palatine was actually probably not the Palatine. It was probably a ship called the Princess Augusta. Which sailed from the Netherlands, and some descendants of the Block Island colonists remembered enough to know that there was one lady left off of the Princess Augusta, who was considered a Palatine survivor. They called her Dutch Catern, and she married and had children and stayed in Block Island, and was believed to be a witch, of course.
Of course.
Yeah. She was a fortune teller. And she would occasionally talk about Holland, and talk about her kindred there as if she'd just seen them. And the Palatine lights themselves, were seen about 12 months after the reports of the Princess Augusta wrecking.
And nothing before that.
Nothing,
huh?
Before that, no.
Well, that's interesting. All right, because I assumed it was just a story that was built up around a natural phenomenon.
People still occasionally report seeing the Palatine lights, but the most of the reports were in the 18th century and the early 19th century, or rather the early late 19th, early 20th century.
All right. Okay. Well, that was a great list of ghost ships.
I try to collect the ones that little rare that nobody really thinks about anymore, but are nonetheless out there floating the seas, probably terrorizing people who don't want to bother reporting them when they come back, because hey, they're nobody sees ghost ships anymore. I mean, how often have you heard of a modern ghost ship report?
That's a good point. But is it because people aren't seeing them anymore? Is the mystique gone? Have we put too much stuff in the ocean?
I think it's the same reason we don't see sea serpents. I think we're just too high up in the ocean. You know, most people are traveling on boats that are way up there. You know, you're way too high. You're down there by the water. You might see a lot more.
Every once in a while, you get a sea serpent report.
Yeah.
Or they'll pull something really big out of the ocean, and they're like, what did we just get? You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because you know, that's my tongue-in-cheek explanation for why we don't see sea serpents or ghost ships anymore, is that we're just not close enough to the water.
Interesting. Yet there are still the occasional Nessie reports.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a lake.
Yeah, you're closer to it.
You can wade in there in a rowboat. I can't see the ocean from the promenade deck of the cruise ship. So it's
right.
It could very well be something there. I would never see it.
So people can find more stories from you where?
People can find many more stories, including more ghost ships, going back many years at esoterics.com.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that. Part two will be next week, unless you're a Patreon, in which case you get both parts right away, plus an extra segment. And thank you to everyone who's a Patreon, everyone who supports us, shares us. You know, everything counts. And it means a lot to keeping this show going and interesting. To take you out tonight, we're going to hear some David Wirsig off his Sunken City EP. This is Black Eyes. This is kind of appropriate to the whole ghost ship thing. And you can find him on Bandcamp. Have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange.
You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And thank you so much for your support.